Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Kate, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Living with Metastatic Skin Cancer, Living with Advanced Skin Cancer. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and this is a two-part series, and so today, the title for today's workshop is on new perspectives in the treatment of metastatic skin cancer, advanced basal cell cancers, and squamous cell cancers. And today's program, because of our collaboration and your interest in the topic, we have a lot of you on the call today. There are over 448 participants on your call today, and you come from all over the United States, from all different regions of this country, and we also have international participants from Canada, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. And it's really a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Today's program was made possible by grants from Genentech, a member of the Roche Group, and Bristol-Myers Squibb, and really want to thank them for their support of the program today. Now, I want to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers and the topics they'll be addressing, and there also is information about all the different collaborating organizations as a resource for each of you. And there is an evaluation form, and I ask you each to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. And when you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics and the programs you would like us to offer going forward? We are planning many programs going forward. We're sort of at the beginning of this year, and we would like to hear all of your recommendations. Indeed, this whole series is one that has been recommended by many of you, and so therefore we're offering this program. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Alan Ho, and Dr. Ho is Medical Oncologist, Department of Medicine, Head and Neck Oncology Service, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Ho is going to address an overview of advanced metastatic skin cancers, including advanced basal cell cancers and metastatic squamous cell cancers, the standard of care, and managing treatment side effects, discomfort, and pain. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Ho.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. Thank you. So, you know, I'm glad to be here, and I'll be, as Dr. Messner mentioned, I'll be speaking about advanced metastatic skin cancers. And just by way of very brief introduction, cancers that originate within the skin are some of the most common types that we as the medical profession faces. And having said that, these cancers are also a very heterogeneous group of diseases, meaning that they are different types of tumors that are driven by different biologic pathways. And so the most common ones that we often encounter clinically are what we call squamous cell carcinomas or basal cell carcinomas, and we'll be speaking to each of those issues in a moment. Now, the overwhelming majority of these cancers, squamous cell carcinomas and basal cell carcinomas, are adequately treated just with either surgery and or radiation alone. It is actually the much more infrequent or uncommon situation when these cancers are not amenable to either surgery or radiation. And it's in those instances where physicians such as myself, a medical oncologist, plays a role in the management of these diseases. And so the title of my section of talk is obviously the treatment of advanced and metastatic skin cancers. And just by way of definition, when we say we often use these terms quite loosely, but when I refer to advanced metastatic cancers, what I'm referring to are either diseases of the skin that can't be adequately treated with either surgery or radiation. So a tumor that's on a specific body part that's too large or too invasive into the skin to be adequately treated with either surgery or radiation, or metastatic. And what metastatic means is when the tumor originates in the skin but then spreads to a distant site. And what we mean by distant sites could include things such as lymph nodes and other organs such as lungs, liver, or bone. So in those situations, chemotherapy is often the treatment of choice for the management of these diseases. And I, as the medical oncologist, are responsible for the administration of chemotherapy for advanced metastatic skin cancers. Now, just as a, you know, by, again, another way of brief introduction, the way that we decide on how to treat cancers in general with drugs, otherwise known as chemotherapy, is really based upon clinical trial evidence. And so we conduct clinical trials in large population of patients with specific type of diseases. And what we garner from those experiences is exactly how effective different treatments are for specific types of cancers. Because as it turns out, different types of cancers respond differently to different chemotherapy drugs. And what we're learning more and more about now is that cancer is a huge heterogeneous set of diseases with different biologies, all of which we need to understand to better predict how patients will respond to chemotherapy. So the reason this applies to advanced or metastatic skin cancers when thinking about chemotherapy is that when we as oncologists encounter these diseases, we often think to ourselves, well, what is the most effective and safe treatments to be administered in these situations? Unlike in diseases such as breast cancer, colon cancer, or lung cancer, where we have large randomized trials demonstrating specific types of drugs are effective in those situations, because of the rarity of advanced or metastatic skin cancers, we don't have a lot of clinical trial evidence to help guide the selection of these agents. Okay. In those situations, we often rely on either one, the experiences from smaller, less robust clinical trials, two, or we extrapolate from other diseases where it seems to make biologic sense that chemotherapies that work in one disease may be also effective for advanced metastatic skin cancers. And I'm going to get a little bit more in detail with regards to squamous cell cancers and basal cell cancers. So I'll start with squamous cell cancers. So again, this is a very common type of cancer that originates in the skin, one of the most common cancers encountered among humans, often easily resected with surgery or radiation, but in those rare instances when it's advanced or metastatic, chemotherapy is indicated. Now, there have been some phase 2 trials done in squamous cell cancers. And when I say phase 2, just by way of introduction, there are three phases of clinical trial development. The first is phase 1, and that's often for drugs that have never been tested in humans before. These are new drugs and new ideas. And the end point of those studies is to find out how safe or toxic drugs are. Phase 2 studies, and these are the ones I'm speaking about for squamous cell cancers, are really designed to find effective drugs for specific type of diseases. And then lastly, phase 3 trials are those that looked effective in phase 2, and then you compare it to another treatment or the routine or standard of care treatment to establish new drugs that can be now made available to the entire population of patients. So that we've never really had a phase 3 trial in advanced metastatic skin cancers, which just, again, speaks to the rarity of these diseases and the lack of information sometimes we're dealing with in selecting our chemotherapy agents. But we do have smaller phase 2 experiences that suggest a list of drugs that may be effective for skin cancers. In addition, squamous cell carcinomas, which is what I'm speaking about, also occur in other body organ sites. And I'm a head and neck medical oncologist, and the reason that we see squamous cell cancers of the skin is because that same type of cancer also originates in the tongue, in the throat, or the upper aero digestive tract. Other sites could also include the lung and the cervix, etc. And so these are more common cancers than squamous cell carcinomas that originate in the skin. And so what we often do is extrapolate from clinical trials done in, say, squamous cell cancers of the throat and say, well, this drug was effective in that situation and perhaps can be used in squamous cell carcinomas of the skin. So Of course, this is not an ideal situation, and hence the importance of performing more clinical trials and developing greater research efforts into getting specific treatments for squamous cell cancers of the skin. There's one treatment I do want to highlight because there was a recent phase 2 study demonstrating the effectiveness of this drug in reducing the size of advanced metastatic squamous cell carcinomas. That drug is called cetuximab or Erbitux. This is a drug that's FDA approved for the use in other cancers such as colon cancer, head and neck cancers, and lung cancers. It's actually not a drug, but an antibody, which for those of you who know, antibodies are produced by our own immune system to recognize different proteins in the body to elicit an immune response. In this situation, the cetuximab recognizes a specific cancer-causing protein on the squamous cell carcinomas of the skin, and by binding that target can induce tumor cell death. And so in this small phase 2 trial, what they saw was that in squamous cell cancers of the skin, they could control the tumor sizes in over half of the patients that they treated. And based upon, and while that is very limited data, just given the lack of clinical trial evidence to guide the treatment of skin cancers, this is often used for patients with squamous cell carcinomas of the skin using this clinical trial's evidence of effectiveness. Okay. So cetuximab is one of several different things that one could consider. There are obviously side effects and toxicities associated with it, including acne-like skin rashes, which Dr. Lacouture, I'm sure, will speak about in a few minutes. And so having said that, when you embark upon chemotherapy treatments for advanced metastatic skin cancers, the primary question that the oncologist and the patient have to ask is how do you balance the potential benefits controlling tumor growth with the potential risks, which is the side effects of the drug. And the only way to kind of get at that question with the patient and the oncologist is to delineate upfront what your goals are for treatment, and this applies to basal cell cancers as well. For me, in advanced metastatic skin cancers, my goals for treatment are to help alleviate tumor-related symptoms such as pain or bleeding or discomfort, and two, then to control and shrink the tumors, and to do this in a way that is not toxic or adversely affects to a large extent the quality of life of the patient. Okay. And so that's, you know, those are the drugs that we think about and the approach we think about for squamous cell cancers. So leaving that behind, I just want to move over to advanced metastatic basal cell carcinomas. There has been some excitement in this field recently with a new FDA approval of a drug, which I'll discuss in a moment. So advanced basal cell cancers, like squamous cell cancers, again, when localized, is often readily treated with surgery and radiation, and in more rare instances, it cannot be treated adequately by those modalities, and even less frequently can metastasize or go to different sites. Just like in squamous cell carcinomas, in those situations, chemotherapy can be considered, and there's even less data to guide what agents would necessarily be used in those diseases. However, there was a major advance several years ago when it was discovered that over 70% of all basal cell cancers harbor something called a gene mutation. And what a gene mutation is a change within the normal DNA of all basal cell cancers, that this change occurred in the same area in the DNA for all these basal cell cancer patients. And the result of that gene mutation is activation of a cancer-causing pathway within those cells that cause them to become cancerous. This was an important discovery because, indeed, there are actually drugs that can turn off that pathway. And so in basal cell cancers where these gene mutations exist and the pathway is activated, if you could use one of these drugs, the hypothesis was, if you could use one of these drugs to treat patients, turn that pathway off, wouldn't you then induce dramatic responses in tumor cells? And that proof of principle actually occurred several years ago in a phase 1 clinical trial where a drug called vismodegib was tested in patients with basal cell cancers. And lo and behold, they had dramatic reductions in their tumor sizes and volumes when treated with this drug. This was a huge advance for the field because, as a rare disease, like I said, there wasn't a lot of treatment options. And generally speaking, it was felt that basal cell carcinomas were refractory or not responsive to chemotherapy in a general sense. That that drug, vismodegib, otherwise known as Erivedge, had then been tested in subsequent clinical trials, and based upon those results, became FDA-approved back in February of 2012, representing the first FDA-approved drug for this chemotherapy drug for this disease. The responses can be quite dramatic, but it doesn't occur in all patients. And so ongoing work to try and identify what predicts response in one versus another is always of interest. And again, just like in the squamous cell carcinoma discussion, the important issues here are really what are our goals of treatment? And again, it's the same as I delineate squamous cell carcinomas, which is the alleviation of tumor-related symptoms such as pain, bleeding, or discomfort, and balancing them with potential side effects. And I'll leave those potential side effects to Dr. Lacouture to discuss, because there are some unique features there. The other unique consideration for basal cell cancers is that while in the rare situation where they're advanced or metastatic, in some patients, this disease grows extremely slowly. So while we now have a new effective treatment, in vismodegib, the initial question that one often has to ask in these situations is whether treatment is warranted at all, because there's a subpopulation of patients who have very slow-growing disease where the disease is present, but it's not causing any symptoms, and from month to month is not growing very much, and these patients can actually be observed or watched for periods of time before initiating treatment. How you adjudicate that is really kind of the art of medicine and figuring out what is reasonable for specific individuals and patients. But that is one unique consideration in basal cell carcinomas that we don't necessarily consider in squamous cell carcinomas. The last thing I would say is that new emerging research has to also be done still in basal cell carcinomas, and still clinical trials is a reasonable option for patients with these advanced and metastatic diseases. Despite the FDA approval of vismodegib, we also do have evidence that over time, these tumors can also grow resistant to that drug. And so there are ongoing efforts to try and map out the mechanisms by which these cancers become resistant and no longer respond to the drug, and to find different treatment or therapeutic strategies to circumvent those mechanisms. And so those kind of studies and those type of approaches are the next generation of trials for basal cell carcinomas and are going to be important for the continued management of these diseases. And so I think I'll just stop there. I think that gives a general overview of chemotherapy for advanced metastatic cancer, and happy to take questions at the end of the talk.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Ho. That was really very informative and really just very lot of information for people and very also cutting edge, and so people feel like they know what the current state of the art is. Thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Mario Lacouture. Dr. Lacouture is Associate Attending Physician, Department of Dermatology, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Lacouture has been really instrumental in really making this program possible in terms of identifying all the best speakers that we have, and just been a wonderful colleague in helping to plan this program. And Dr. Lacouture is going to address caring for your skin during your cancer treatments and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Lacouture.
Thank you, Caroline. It's always great to be a part of Cancer Care's programs because I think they provide an invaluable tool of information and key tips for people to go through their treatment in an easier way. I'll be speaking about most of the side effects that appear with the advanced therapies that Dr. Ho mentioned previously, but I would like to start from how to care for your skin even after the first diagnosis of cancer is made. In other words, after people have a biopsy or have a surgical procedure for the removal of their initial skin cancer, the skin heals in a way that can cause certain problems. For example, about 20% of people after they have a surgical procedure may develop a problem scar. By a problem scar, I mean scars that can be itchy, painful, large, or unsightly. all of these conditions of a scar, itchy, painful, unsightly, or large, can be treated in the majority of cases by a dermatologist or a plastic surgeon. If your scar is itchy, topical corticosteroid creams can be used. If your scar is painful, injections of anti-inflammatory medicines can also be used. And if your scar is very large, other treatments can be used, such as injection of steroid medication into the scar, or in some cases, a small surgical procedure to remove that scar, followed by a special cream to minimize its regrowth. If the scar is unsightly, here laser treatments can be effective, or consultation with a plastic surgeon that can perform a procedure called a scar revision and make the scar thinner and more aligned with certain skin lines that make it less visible. Now, another treatment that Dr. Ho mentioned was radiation. And we do know that radiation is a valuable tool in a great number of skin cancers. And in some cases, when people's skin cancers grow large and become problematic or painful because they block the movement of certain limbs or joints, radiation can be a very useful tool. Also, it is used in early stages of cancer to prevent the cancer from coming back. Radiation has its own set of side effects. Although the majority of patients will not have complications from radiation, in about 30% of people, radiation will lead to skin irritation and burning. When the skin is irritated or broken down with radiation, the skin can become easily infected. And once the skin becomes damaged from the radiation, symptoms of itching or pain from an infection can occur. These can be easily treated by your doctor or your oncology nurse with the use of topical corticosteroids and oral antibiotics. It is important to know that every time that a part of your skin has been radiated and feels itchy or painful, it indicates that there is some degree of inflammation in the skin, all of which can be treated and improved with the use of topical or oral medications prescribed by your doctor. So make sure to inform your doctor of any of the side effects that you may be experiencing. And finally, Dr. Ho mentioned these new therapies that have been approved for the treatment of other types of cancers in terms of squamous cell cancers of the skin. And in terms of basal cell cancer, the new drug, bismodegib, for the treatment of this disease when it is in its advanced stages. First, speaking about squamous cell cancers, Dr. Ho mentioned a medication known as cetuximab or Erbitux. This medication has been approved for almost 10 years for the treatment of other cancers. What is notable about this medication from a skincare perspective is that up to 90% of people can develop a rash that appears on the face and upper body. This rash occurs usually within the first month and looks like acne. We all know what acne felt like when we were teenagers, but having acne as an adult can be problematic for many reasons, not only because this is really not acne, because it is also very itchy and painful and can also affect the scalp. So people, when they are treated with this medication, cetuximab, can develop this acne-like rash, which can be very debilitating. The good thing to know is that this rash can be prevented in the majority of people by taking oral antibiotics prescribed by your doctor at the initiation of cetuximab therapy. In addition to this, using a topical corticosteroid daily to your face and chest at the initiation of cetuximab therapy can also help reduce the severity of the rash by about 50%. In addition to this rash occurring within the first 1 to 2 months, people can develop very dry skin with the use of cetuximab. We all know what dry skin feels like, but dry skin is not only important because the skin may not look moisturized, but dry skin may allow for more water loss from your body. It may also allow for the penetration of bacteria or viruses into the skin, causing secondary infections. And this is also even more common when the skin is dry, because when the skin is dry, it can become itchy. We all know what happens when the skin becomes itchy, we start scratching it, which in itself will also allow the introduction of bacteria that can lead to secondary skin infections. In fact, we know that about a third of people that are treated with cetuximab and develop skin problems will have some type of skin infection as a consequence of this side effect. So if your skin is dry, it is very important to moisturize your skin at least twice daily. Remember that you have to use a generous amount of moisturizer within 15 minutes of taking a shower or bath, and then again in the evening. Another important factor that must be taken into consideration for people that have dry skin is to use fragrance-free soaps in the shower and fragrance-free detergents when washing your clothes, as any fragrances will dry the skin out even more. There are also a variety of topical moisturizers that are better than what you could obtain over the counter. These are usually prescribed by a dermatologist, and they contain different ingredients, such as ammonium lactate, salicylic acid, and urea. So ask your doctor or dermatologist if you feel like you're having very dry skin that does not improve despite applying copious amounts of over-the-counter moisturizers. Moving on to a different side effect that may occur with the use of this medication, cetuximab, for head and neck or throat cancers, as well as advanced squamous cell cancers of the skin, is inflammation around the fingernails or toenails. About 20% of people treated with this medication will develop very brittle nails and in some cases ingrown nails. This condition can be quite painful, but can be treated with the use of topical antibiotics and in some cases a small surgical procedure done in a dermatologist's office in which the nail is clipped and at the end so that the nail is not ingrown anymore. This condition is known as paronychia. Please inform your doctor if you are having any signs and symptoms of pain around the finger or toenails during your treatment. And finally, hair changes are also common with cetuximab and related medications. The hair can become very curly. Women are very affected because they can develop increased hair growth in the face. Men can also develop increased hair growth in the face, but they can lose the hair in their scalp. Interestingly, the hair in the face can become more dark, coarse, and thicker than the person ever had before. So many women, when I see them for side effects to this medication, will ask what is the best way to remove excess facial hair when they are treatment on cetuximab. I usually recommend either plucking or also procedure that is done in salons called threading, in which using two threads, a cosmetologist is able to remove the excess hairs. Of course, lasers can be used, but they are very expensive. I do not recommend the use of chemical depilatories or waxing, since the skin with these medications is very thin to begin with and very sensitive, and the use of chemical depilatories or waxing can really cause inflammation in the skin and burning. I would also like to mention that with the use of this medication, cetuximab, the skin by itself can also become itchy. Keep in mind that one of the ways to treat itchy skin is by using topical corticosteroids prescribed by a dermatologist or an oncologist. Also, minimize hot water in the shower or bath, and also, again, using fragrance-free detergents or soaps are key. The use of oral antihistamines may also be useful to minimize itching. These oral antihistamines are available over-the-counter. You may have heard of some of them, called Zyrtec or Benadryl, and these can be used safely. However, their main side effect is dry mouth, and also they cause some degree of sleepiness. So be careful if you are already feeling tired from your medication. Now, moving on to the other medication Dr. Ho alluded to, Vismodegib, this medication has really revolutionized the treatment of advanced basal cell cancers. However, it is not without certain side effects, all of which in the majority of cases can be manageable. About 70% of people on bismodegib can develop muscle spasms. Painful muscle contractions can occur in people in about 70%. So it is important to inform your oncologist whenever you are experiencing these so that they can give you anti-spasm medications and anti-pain medications so that you can continue on your bismodegib treatment. Other side effects that are very frequent include hair thinning on the scalp as well as dry skin. If you are on this medication and are experiencing hair thinning, there are a variety of techniques that can be done to minimize the appearance of thinning hair. Importantly, with bismodegib, you will not lose all of your hair, but your hair will become substantially thin. There are a variety of camouflaging methods, such as sprays and powders, the use of over-the-counter minoxidil or Rogaine, that may be effective in mitigating the appearance of thin hair. And one of the most important side effects that we don't really know how to treat well is this change in taste that appears in about 50% of people. It turns out that about 50% of people on bismodegib develop this altered metallic or cardboard sensation whenever they drink water or eat. So it is important to report this to your doctor so that a specific diet can be recommended. In summary, the majority of side effects from these medications can be prevented or treated effectively so that people can continue on their anti-cancer treatment. It is important not to hide or not to mention these effects to your oncologist. Most oncologists are very adamant about treating people's cancer, but also improving their lives. So by reporting these side effects to your oncologist, you will improve your lives and the ability of your oncologist to help you do so. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. LaCouture. That was a wonderful presentation, as always, and very informative about managing skin during cancer treatments. Dr. LaCouture has written a book on this topic as well for the public, and it's very very helpful in terms of as a guide for all of you in terms of reading and understanding more about all of the different, some of the side effects and of your skin and how those can be best managed as well. Our next speaker now is Dr. Jean Tang, and Dr. Tang is Assistant Professor of Dermatology, Stanford School of Medicine, member BioX, member Stanford Cancer Institute. And Dr. Tang is going to address new treatment approaches, clinical trial updates, and how research contributes to treatment options. It's my pleasure now to introduce Dr. Tang.
Hi, everybody. This is Jean Tang, and I appreciate being on this call. I wanted to tell you today about some of the new research for basal cell carcinoma, BCCs. The importance of research is really well demonstrated in the bismodegib clinical trial approval and success story. How does research help our daily lives? Well, bismodegib was originally discovered probably 10 years ago, and the importance of the hedgehog signaling pathway, this is a tumor signaling pathway that is important for the driving of BCC tumors, not melanoma and not squamous cell cancer. Basic scientists identified that this tumor signaling pathway was important for BCCs about 30 years ago. Then they developed mouse models of these tumors. Then they discovered and tested new drugs for treatment. And as the earlier speakers discussed, bismodegib is the first hedgehog signaling inhibitor that is now FDA approved for the treatment of metastatic BCC and advanced BCCs for which surgery and radiation is not treatable. I'm speaking to you today about non-FDA approved uses of bismodegib and other hedgehog inhibitors for the treatment of BCCs. Most BCCs can be treated by surgery, destructive modalities through chemotherapy creams or liquid nitrogen. However, now there are new ways to treat BCCs, especially in patients with a rare disease called Gorlin syndrome or basal cell nevus syndrome. In these patients, while they do not necessarily have metastatic BCCs, they have 20 or hundreds of BCCs for which we have done clinical trial testing where patients take bismodogib for several months and virtually all of their BCC tumors disappear from their skin. Dr. LaCouture mentioned some of the side effects associated with bismodogib, and these were the same side effects we saw in our Gorlin syndrome patients. Namely, these patients had taste disturbance, muscle cramps, and hair loss. But for this specific type of patient population, where surgery was not possible and radiation was not possible, those side effects were very tolerable given the anti-cancer effect. If you have a significant morbidity and the basal cells have significant effect on your quality of life, those side effects are certainly well tolerated. We've also done research and clinical trials applying bismodogib to patients prior to surgery. And in a small group of 10 patients that we have tested, bismodogib shrinks the BCC tumors such that the scar and the surgery, the wound healing time is improved compared to standard surgical treatment. And so those are two exciting pieces of clinical trial data that we have. I also want to talk a little bit about prevention versus treatment. The prior clinical trials I discussed were mainly for treatment of BCCs. There's also clinical research on how do you prevent BCCs. Some of you may have read about this in the New York Times or other media outlets. Researchers have tested aspirin-like compounds such as celecoxib, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory inhibitors, NSAIDs, such as aspirin. Others have tested vitamin D or topical retinoids as well. And those indications and those clinical trials or studies are really for prevention. So I just really wanted to highlight the differences between treatment versus prevention in BCC clinical trials. I also wanted to say that for BCCs that are multiple, the patients that we tested took bismodogib as a daily pill, 150 milligrams per day, and we followed these patients for up to 3 years. And yes, while the side effects are there, for the right patient population with a high burden of BCC disease, this drug has really revolutionized their treatment and their quality of life. For the typical patient with one, maybe two small BCCs, most likely this chemotherapy pill is not worth it. But the important thing is to discuss what are all the different treatment modalities with your physician, whether they're a dermatologist or an oncologist, because today in 2013, we have new treatments that were not available 2 years ago. And it's a very exciting time and very, very happy time for the patient who has now multiple treatment options. So this summarizes some of the clinical trial discussions topics that I really wanted to present today. And I think a number of our previous speakers have touched upon different treatment modalities for advanced or metastatic BCCs, other treatment for squamous cell cancer. And I know part two of this program will really discuss melanoma treatments. So I wanted to ask the moderator if there were specific questions.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Tang, for excellent presentation and for really covering these issues. And we will be taking questions shortly. Our next speaker is Sarah Kelly. Sarah is an oncology social worker at Cancer Care, and Sarah will be discussing the free psychosocial services offered by Cancer Care and the role of support groups. I'm now going to turn this program over to Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Carolyn. I also want to thank Dr. Tang and Dr. LaCouture and also Dr. Ho. I think this is, you know, a lot of information, but a lot of really good, really important information we've gotten today. So as Carolyn said, I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care. I work with many people with skin cancer, also their loved ones. And I really want to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with a cancer and actually how cancer care can be a part of that network. I think there are a lot of ways that we can help. So cancer care, if you aren't aware, is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our programs include individual counseling. We provide that face-to-face in the New York area, and we actually provide it over the telephone nationally. We do support groups, which are face-to-face in the New York area. We do them over the phone nationally, and we also do them online. We have education about resources, how to navigate the healthcare system. We provide, you know, practical help and some limited financial assistance, as well as chemotherapy copay assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's-level oncology social workers, and they are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They're also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as financial demands, you know, physical changes, social adjustment, psychological impact and care. You know, Dr. Ho used the word balance, and I think, you know, with a cancer diagnosis, so often we're trying to achieve the balance, whether it's, you know, between the symptoms from the cancer itself and, of course, the symptoms from side effects, but also just how, you know, we can maintain balance in our lives. You know, I think adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is a huge part of this and also an important part of the healing process. You know, as you know, cancer, it doesn't just affect the person who's diagnosed and, you know, affect the body part that is, afflicted with this. It also is affecting the whole person and the entire support network. And asking for help, and I really can't stress this enough, by joining a support group or, you know, contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. You know, you don't have to do this on your own. Joining a support group, you know, with that, you're able to connect with others who are going through something similar. You know, they get it in a lot of ways because they have similar side effects and, you know, are trying to adjust to this in the same way you are. Individual counseling, which we also provide, you know, really gives you a space that's just yours to voice any concerns that are coming up for you. And I think when you have these types of connections, it helps to lessen the isolation that a lot of people who are diagnosed with cancer may feel. I think feeling well emotionally really can help you better adapt to the diagnosis and the treatment. You know, again, this is not something you have to do on your own. You don't have to walk this on your own. If you're interested in our services, I highly recommend checking out our websites. Our website is very comprehensive. There's a lot of additional information on your diagnosis, treatment, and also just coping with a lot of this. And that's www.cancercare.org. And then you can always call us on the Hope Line. You know, we're here for you. It's 1-800-813-4673. You know, there's a lot of information on today's program. It's a lot to digest, a lot to get your arms around. You know that we're here to help you understand what it means for you and for your family. You know, a social worker really can help you prioritize, and if you need to, even rehearse questions you may have for the medical team to get the answers and information you need. You know, again, we're here for you if you need us. We're here to help. Thank you so much for your attention, also the opportunity to speak today.
Well, thank you very much, Sarah, for that wonderful presentation about cancer care, our services, and that the recommendation that people certainly call and ask for help. And it's kind of in keeping with the discussion about communicating with your healthcare team as well, that you want to ask people what you need and ask for help. That's really very important. Help is available. Well, now we have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions, and I'm going to ask Kate to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get to your question, then please, you know, call us at the end of the call at 1-800-813-HOPE, and we're here to, of course, answer your questions. But let's see if we can take more of your questions right now. And Kate, could you explain to the audience how to queue up for questions and bring all of our speakers on board?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Okay, and so we do have a question from one of our online participants who's just queued up and asked a question. And the question was that basal cell and squamous cell cancers run in my family. What are tips or measures I can take now to prevent my young children from getting skin cancer? So, Dr. Ho or Dr. Tang, would you like to address that?
This is Dr. Tang. The number one recommendation that is safe and clinically proven is to avoid excess sun exposure. What your genetics have told you in terms of your family history is that your children probably have a 2- to 3-fold increased risk of developing basal cell or squamous cell cancer. So at this moment, what you can do is to make sure that your children do not purposely get suntans, do not have sunburns, and use adequate sun protection methods, whether it's wearing a large brimmed hat, long sleeves, seeking shade during peak sun times, and using sunscreen with an SPF 30 or above. That is very clear, very efficacious, and very safe.
Excellent. Thank you. Another question like this, what can I do to prevent getting skin cancer besides using sunscreen? Dr. Tang or Dr. Ho, would you like to address that one?
I can add to
that. Oh, yes. Oh, Dr. LaCouture. Okay, yes.
Excellent. Yeah. I can add that besides that, people also, you know, I've noticed in my practice that a lot of people don't like to use sunscreen, so it's also important for people to know that, you know, there are certain times of day between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. that are the highest ultraviolet radiation concentration is present. So if they are going to be doing activities outside, to avoid those times. And also, I've noticed, especially men don't like to use sunscreen, so there is also a variety of products, sun-protected protective clothing, that and this clothing is sold online or in certain stores, and it also prevents the sun's harmful ultraviolet radiation from getting through to the skin. So those are two additional factors that may be emphasized. And, of course, if anyone suffers from any disease that suppresses their immune system or is on any medication that suppresses their immune system or as part of a transplant of a kidney or heart or another organ, it is also important for them to know that they are at a very high risk for developing skin cancers and they need to see their dermatologist regularly.
Excellent.
This is Dr. Tang. I can't emphasize Dr. LaCouture's point well enough. There are a lot of different patient characteristics that are important to address any kind of recommendation. And the number one recommendations are avoid excessive sun exposure, see your dermatologist for a tailored plan that is relevant to your daily health practices so that whatever you implement, it can be effective for skin cancer prevention, especially if you've suffered from it already.
And although I think this was addressed, if someone's asked this question, what is actinic keratosis and what does it look like? Dr. Ho, is that? Or Dr. LaCouture?
If you want, Jean.
Dr. Tang. Actinic keratoses are considered precursors to squamous cell cancer. Not every actinic keratosis will develop into a squamous cell cancer, but perhaps 1 in 10 over several years. Clinically, what does it look like? It looks like a small scab, a small flaky piece of dry skin, usually on your forehead, on your face, that no matter what you do, the scab or the flaky skin reappears. You might be able to wash it off, rub it off. It comes and goes, but it always comes back at the same place. The treatment for actinic keratosis is easy. A little bit of liquid nitrogen or cryotherapy to burn the abnormal cells. There's no surgery involved at all. The actinic keratosis is an important indicator for future skin cancer. My patients who have many actinic keratoses, those are the individuals who are likely to develop a basal cell, a squamous cell, or a melanoma in the future. So it's almost as if your skin is saying, guess what? I've had enough sun exposure. I'm at risk for skin cancer. I should get yearly checkups with my dermatologist.
Excellent. Thank you. Another question is, I was diagnosed with basal cell skin cancer last spring. What are my chances of developing another skin cancer?
The epidemiology data tell us that your chance of developing another skin cancer is about 50%. Many patients with basal cell cancer go on to develop another basal cell cancer 3 years after the first diagnosis.
So that so what would you suggest in terms of just surveillance and follow-up care?
For surveillance, this is somebody who needs to be seen probably twice a year with their dermatologist. Skin checks by the individual are important and by the dermatologist are important. A basal cell, 99% of them, will not metastasize, will not cause harm, and the best treatment is to catch it early.
Thank you.
And surgery and many of the destructive modalities, whether it's chemotherapy creams or liquid nitrogen or small scrape and burn procedure, those cure most BCCs. When it's small, it's a very small procedure.
And this is a question actually for all of our speakers. Can you say a little bit about the location of these skin cancers in terms of how they're treated, in terms of does the location matter if it's visible versus if it's not in a visible area of the body?
Well, I think that it impacts the care to some degree. When we were defining, what we would consider advanced malignancies of the skin, to some extent, part of that definition was disease that was not amenable necessarily to surgical resection. Of course, how amenable different tumors are to surgical resection to some degree depends upon their location. For instance, a lesion, the same size lesion on the back may be resectable, but one on the nose or on a critical part of the face may be more complicated for resection. So in those situations, location and can mean can make a difference in terms of how amenable they are to certain modalities of treatment.
And then in terms of just the care of the skin in general, Dr. LaCouture, I think there are some just questions about the different skin, in terms of the dry skin, in terms of how to care for one's skin. If you could say a bit more about that, Dr. LaCouture.
Yes, especially with both of the treatments that were mentioned by Dr. Tang and Dr. Ho, the cetuximab, avoidance of soaps or detergents that have a lot of fragrances, the ones that smell very good, are those that irritate skin the most, so avoiding those. Also, avoiding hot showers or very lengthy baths will also be important. And the use of moisturizers. There are many moisturizers that people don't know about, that a dermatologist would know about, because they contain other ingredients that remove that flaky skin that is on the surface that makes the skin look ashy and sometimes become itchy. So talk to your dermatologist for moisturizers that contain ammonium lactate or salicylic acid, as these can improve the feel and and minimize the itching of the skin. Also, it is important to use clothing that is cotton-based, and if you do experience significant itching when you apply anything to your skin, discuss it with your dermatologist, because this may indicate an allergy to a component in the fabric or in the detergent that you are using, and most people are surprised to know that they can develop allergies even later in life to anything in the environment. So please inform this to your doctor or any other side effect that you may be experiencing during your treatment so that if you are receiving a treatment for skin cancer, it does not have to be interrupted.
Excellent. And a general question, which I'm going to ask everyone to address, the last question is, Ellen's asking this question, what can I do to actually get ready for treatment? How do I prepare myself for treatment? So that's a question that affects a lot of our patients in terms of what to do. Dr. Ho, would you like to start with that?
Sure, yeah. Well, I think there are a couple of things. I think number one is the physical and the mental aspects are kind of the two things that I think about. In terms of the physical, I always tell my patients that in preparation and during therapy, it is vital that they not only get good nutrition, but they stay as active as possible. I think that one thing that sometimes get lost is the potential benefits of remaining active and maintaining what we call a performance status. The issues there are, of course, the more deconditioned or more sedentary the patients are, the more prone you are to more susceptible you are to potential toxicities of drugs and other complications of your disease. And while this is not well borne out in a lot of different cancers in other settings like in breast cancer or colon cancer, active and healthier lifestyles translate to better outcomes. And we certainly know it's certainly logical to think that the way you start out before treatment is certainly going to affect the way you come out of it. So physically, I think good nutrition and good activity. You're not training for a marathon, but just maintaining good activity is important for your ability to tolerate and get through treatment. There are no specific dietary recommendations that I often make. And this is a question that often comes up. I think a balanced diet, the same diets that's recommended for all of us for non-cancer patients are the same for cancer patients. There are a lot of diets out there, and I think there are specific risks and benefits to different specific ones. But there's no specific diet that I necessarily endorse. And I think the sometimes more challenging aspect to this is the mental aspect, and particularly when you are being treated with chemotherapy for your malignancy. It can be difficult. It can be difficult not only physically, but also difficult mentally. And to some degree, because the effectiveness of your treatment is not going to be well understood or known for at least weeks to even months. The way the treatment is administered, the chemotherapy is given or taken for a period of time, and then tumors are reassessed, whether it be by radiologic imaging or just by clinical exam. And often that waiting and anticipation of how things are going is often preoccupies patients. And so one of the biggest challenges in this setting is not only having a long view of your treatment, but also having a day-to-day view of your treatment that doesn't necessarily preoccupy one with anxiety. And this is a mental and psychological transition that a lot of patients can and will make with the help of their family and friends and support. It's a difficult one, but it's one that's achievable and one that will help certainly with your outcomes for therapy.
Excellent. That was really an outstanding really answer to that whole issue here. I thank you. And I want to thank all of you who've been listening on today's program. It's been an amazing program, a lot of important information that has been shared with all of you. And I want to remind all of you that, of course, if you do have questions or concerns, to call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE. And that most importantly, as we conclude the program, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with skin cancer, in coping with cancer in general. And I want you to now know that you're part of a community of support and we're here to help you. And that means that you can call us at any time. Our staff provide a host of services for you. We have a staff of social workers who provide both practical and financial assistance and counseling and support groups. And we have, of course, many of these education workshops. Indeed, we have a part two of this workshop on June 14th, which will focus really on emerging treatments for metastatic melanoma. So, again, I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect and have a wonderful day.